First, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to be here in Toronto and experience the nice hospitality of the Fields Institute. I will talk about quantum computation with trapped ions. Here is the plan of my talk. I will first introduce you to the basic experimental techniques which we use in ion trapping, then talk about multiparticle experiments which we have done recently, show you our attempts to implement entanglement swapping in this system, and then we step back actually and look at the process tomography of a controlled knot operation to understand why we sort of failed here. And finally, I will give you another idea how you can scale up ion trap quantum computers where we actually electrically couple or want to couple ion qubits. So this is the group of Rainer Platt. It's a large group, and we are happy to have many, many sponsors. And so let's first come to motivation. The long-term goal, as we just discussed, is a universal quantum computer. But we all know that this is a very hard thing. So, and I think what drives at least me is that I want to understand quantum mechanics in the lab. I want to see really how things work, and that's really nice in the lab to sit there. You see what a projective measurement is and all these things. Can also realize really real bizarre Gedanken experiments like teleportation. And what is maybe a little bit more serious is that we want to extend our knowledge to the limits, and quantum mechanics has to fail at some point. No theory so far really proved. Basically, every theory failed so far. And why should it be different with quantum mechanics? So where does it fail? Why would you investigate these things with ion traps? There are a few good things about ion traps. Ion traps are really excellent quantum memories. Single qubit coherence times of larger than 10 minutes have been already demonstrated by Dave Vineland a long time ago. Ions can also be controlled very well. That means the internal, the electronic degrees of freedom, and also the motional degrees of freedom. And there are at least three ideas how you can scale up ion traps. However, there are, of course, some bad things. And the worst thing, I think, it's technically very demanding. And that means that we will need chip traps. We will probably also need integrated control electronics for the electrodes. We need stable lasers, stabilized magnetic fields, and all these kinds of things. And put all these things together, and it gets really nasty. So this is such a nasty sight. This is the apparatus. Actually, it's half of the apparatus. The physics, however, is relatively simple, and it happens in this vacuum chamber. We have what's called a Paul trap. It's an electrode configuration in which we can store, for instance, the ions. As you can see here. And each of those ions represents now our qubit. This is the level scheme of calcium 40 plus, which we use. We have a ground, S1 half ground state, and a D5 half excited state. This forms the qubit and can be actually more than a qubit, can be a qutrit, and actually there are 8 levels available, and we sometimes even. So we have done experiments where we actually use 3 of those. We have also this fast transition here, and actually the fluorescence you see here from this CCD image comes from this transition here. So what do we do in our experiments? In the first step, we initialize our system in what you might call a pure quantum state, although it's never pure, of course, but with a probability of larger than 99%, we are in a specific state. This happens with Doppler cooling and what's called sideband cooling on the narrower qubit transition. In the second step, we do then the actual quantum state manipulation, and then finally we have to read, to read out. And this we do by simply irradiating the ion on this transition here. And if the ion is in the ground state, we detect fluorescence, and on the CCD image, this could look like this. If the ion is, however, projected into the D level, the ion remains dark and we don't see anything. And we can do that spatially resolved, and here you see for a two-ion string the possible outcomes. Two ions are fluorescing, only the first one, and so forth. We do these experiments with a rate of about 50 experiments per second, and repeat usually the experiments for 100 or 200 times. We can also address these, we don't only see these atoms individually, we can also address them individually. And this here is the path, the way we look at the atoms. We shine in now a laser, the qubit manipulation along the same path through the same objective here to the ions. And in this way, we can now address a single ion. And by changing the voltage on this device, which works similar to an electro-optical deflector, we can move the laser beam, steer it around, and can then make scans like this. Here, the deflector voltage is scanned, and the excitation on the various ions is recorded. And you can see that the excitation here, for instance, for this ion gets high. And then when you address, for instance, this ion here, the excitation of the neighboring ions is rather small. Okay, it's down here at this point. So in this way, we are able to address each ion, and we are able to do this in a coherent way. This is the population of the metastable upper D level as a function of the pulse time, or the time for which we apply this laser pulse. And you can see here Rabi oscillations. And this corresponds, you can look at that as a rotating the Bloch vector on a Bloch sphere. However, we need also to couple the ions to each other. It's not enough to manipulate each ion. And for this, we use actually the fact that all these ions are stored in the same trap, and they experience a common motion of about megahertz usually. And this is here, this is not the classical, this is a classical motion which is shown here. This is not a quantum motion, just to avoid confusion. So here, but this shows the center of mass mode where all ions simultaneously oscillate. And that mode we will actually use as the quantum bus. So how do we describe things quantum mechanically? We have a quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator that is the center of mass mode. And I will stretch the level scheme now to make space for our two-level approximation of the ion, which is here. And then you end up with this level scheme. And these carrier transitions on which I showed you the Rabi oscillations are those transitions where the motion of the ion crystal is not changed. And this happens when you detune your laser not at all from the transition. However, you can, of course, detune your laser, and at some point you get into resonance with this transition where simultaneously to exciting the ion, you also create one motional excitation in the ion crystal. And, of course, on the other side, this will be then the so-called red sideband. All our quantum manipulations, which we will do, will actually happen either on the carrier transition or on the blue sideband for the future. So we have this coherent manipulations on the carrier transition, and also on the blue sideband, we have also coherent operations. The time scales are such that the carrier transitions are usually about one or two orders of magnitude faster. And that is because the sideband transitions are suppressed by the so-called Lempdicke factor. So with that, I want to turn actually to the first kind of experiments I want to present to you. And this will be a lot of stuff, so feel free when you know something to have a nap and then kick in later. So first, first I probably don't need to do this, but I still do it. When do we call a state, or what is entanglement? And people define first when a state is separable, and a state is separable when you can write it as a tensor product of two states. And if you cannot do this, you call a state entangled. The problem I have with that definition is that you cannot really tell how much a state is entangled, and actually there's so far no agreement how to quantify entanglement. And therefore, I don't know whether entanglement is at all the right way to think about these things, whether entanglement in that sense makes sense. Okay. But still, why could we be interested in entanglement? Okay, people claim, and probably most of us believe this, that during a quantum computation, a quantum register necessarily gets entangled if you want to have a gain from the quantum computer as compared to classical computer. The problem I see, however, is that there's, from the experimental side, I'm not aware of any experiment which characterized the decoherence property of an entangled state with more than, let's say, two qubits. We have done some work, but we have never really published it. And the question, of course, is also how interesting it is, because we usually find what we expect. But on the other hand, I think it could be really that maybe something happens for, I don't know, 3,000 qubits or whenever. So what we want to do is we want to look at the properties of entangled quantum registers to study really feasibility of quantum computing, because if we have a problem here with the coherence properties for some unknown reason, I mean, we cannot do quantum computation. Or this is the alternative motivation, and I don't need to tell you which I like more. Okay, so here we are. We concentrate on the production of W states. A W state is a state where exactly one particle is excited and all other particles are not excited. And it's a symmetric combination of those. And here's the density matrix, which we measured about 3 years ago. We had a reasonable fidelity of 85%, and it compares well with what you would expect from a W state. So how did we produce those W states? What I've drawn you here is an energy level diagram of a three-ion crystal plus the one motional mode. So this is basically energy, and we want to achieve a symmetric superposition of those states here. And what is fairly easy is to initialize the quantum register in that state simply by two pi pulses starting from the SS0 state. In the first step, we apply a blue pulse of a certain length such that we get a population splitting a larger fraction up into the DD1 state. So what has happened is that this rightmost ion here is excited, and simultaneously a phonon is created. In the next step, we apply again another blue pulse such that half of that population actually up here is moved down. So simultaneously to flipping the center qubit, the phonon is destroyed. And the important thing now to realize is that to that population, nothing happens because there's simply no level it could couple to, because you cannot destroy a phonon if you don't have one. And now it's also clear what we do next. We also transfer this population from up here down here, and here also nothing happens. And in this way, we arrived really at the W state. This scheme is really, okay, let me first say something else. So we have now created this W state, and we have to analyze it somehow. As an example, I took here a Bell state, and what you expect is when you do now a measurement is that you, for this Bell state, which can be actually seen as also a W state, you get this, you would expect either the left or the right ion to be fluorescent, and those things not to appear at all. Those events would not appear. The question, of course, is this a coherent superposition or is it just a mixture? And, of course, also, which is actually the same question, what is the relative phase of this superposition? And the answer you can retrieve by measuring basically the density matrix. And I want to explain this quickly. Okay. So this is my point of view, how you can measure a density matrix. I think very simple. The diagonal of the density matrix is, okay, almost trivial. You just do a measurement. You project onto the z-axis. That's what your measurement does, at least in this basis. What you can do to access the other matrix element is elements prior to detection, you can rotate your qubit by with a pi over two pulse, for instance, here around the x-axis. And when you measure now the projection onto the z-axis, this was the original projection onto the y-axis. And in this way, you have access to the other density matrix elements. You can, of course, also rotate around the y-axis prior to the measurement. And this way, you can get the remaining imaginary part. In this way, you can fully characterize a single qubit. And you can do that also for two qubits by combining all sorts of rotations and doing some processing and maximum likelihood estimation, which we learned, I think was yesterday or the day before yesterday, might not be necessarily the best way to do it, but nevertheless, we didn't know better at that time. And so here it is. It's a density matrix of an 8 I and W states, or we just generalize this, the production scheme I sketched to 8 ions. It works reasonably well. The fidelity is above 70%. Measurement time is 10 hours, and yesterday I actually started to re-evaluate the data, and well, the server is still running. So it really means it's really slow to from the data to retrieve the density matrix, and the scaling law is actually really, really bad for us there. It goes to the basis to which it goes is 24. So one, you add one qubit and you need a factor of 24 times more computational time to reconstruct it. So it will be very hard, even if you have a quantum computer and you have measured all necessary things to characterize your state, let's say a 12-qubit state or whatever, it would take ages to retrieve from that data the density matrix. So we have done these measurements for various number of ions. Here is the number of ions. Next to it you see the fidelity which we achieve for this number of ions. You can see it decreases, but the decrease is not too bad, actually. Then there's this row with the witness operator. Here we basically had our friends from the theory department construct a witness operator in such a way that it has a positive expectation value for all separable states. What that means is that if it's negative, the state must have been entangled. And you can see there's a negative sign. Okay, it's still negative. And what that means is that we have genuine multiparticle entanglement in the system. And another measurement for the entanglement could be that you calculate the minimum of the concurrence over all bipartite partitions you can make. In this case, we projected first the rest of the density matrix onto the 0-0 state. And what that means is that you can distill any entangled state or any state, any 8-qubit state from many, many copies of the type of state which we created by local operations and classical communications only. And as these operations cannot create entanglement, that must mean that the original state was also entangled. So this analysis and the theoretical help was from Ottfried and Wolfgang. So what is the state of the art right now with trapped ions? So at the same time, a 6-ion GHC state in Boulder, it was sort of a Schrödinger cat state, was created, which might be interesting for quantum error correction schemes and also for metrology reasons. And we have measured the density matrix of an 8-ion W state, and you can be maybe interested in the decoherence properties of that state, and you can also think about schemes to measure some quantities with this. I want to mention also that both states are entangled, but they are inequivalent. And at least for our scheme, I can say that we don't make use of any resources. At least I'm not aware of any, and this means that we have, in principle, scalable entanglement. However, okay, it's clear it ends rather quickly. What I put in extra yesterday night, I sat down and analyzed also some data where we actually created a 4-ion W state and then waited some time before we measured the density matrix. And you can see here, can follow here really the decoherence of a 4-ion W state. So we start with a reasonable high fidelity after a waiting time of 0 milliseconds. And 50 milliseconds later, the fidelity is still reasonably high. And you have to compare that to the production time of a few hundred microseconds. So still after 100 times the production, no, this is actually 1,000 times the production time, the fidelity, the W state is still sort of there. So this entanglement is reasonably robust. But this is a special case here. For instance, Bell states, the situation, we investigated that situation 2 years ago and found the following behavior. We found Bell states which are quite long-lived and Bell states, which are really short-lived. So there's three orders of magnitude between those two. And the question, of course, is why is that so? For this, you can have a look at the energy diagram. These Bell states here consist out of superpositions of the same energy, and those have drastically different energies. And what is clear now, if you have a fluctuation in the energy scale here, this leads immediately to decoherence on this side, but not on this side. And such energy fluctuations are, for instance, provided by magnetic fields. And yeah, I should mention also that this was also in an engineered way seen by the Weinland group about 5 years ago. So this is the quintessence of our decoherence-free subspaces. On this side, we have lifetimes which are limited only by the D level, and here the Bell states lifetime is limited by the laser frequency fluctuation. You can even improve on the lifetime on these Bell states by transferring the quantum information from superpositions between the S and the D level by moving the D level population to another S level population. The splitting here is provided by the Siemann splitting. And this way you get rid of that decoherence mechanism. And when you do now the analysis, here is plotted the fidelity. It's actually a lower bound of the fidelity as a function of the waiting time. And you can see that even after more than 20 seconds, the state was entangled. So entanglement can stay around for quite some time. Okay, I want to finish up this part by showing you the timescales which we are currently looking at in ion traps. You can have single qubit gates which are significantly faster actually than a microsecond. Two qubit gates in Boulder are currently in the order of 10 microseconds. We are looking more at a few hundred of microseconds. Single qubit coherence, which you have currently in the lab, is in the order of 10 milliseconds, and the coherence of the motion is about 100 milliseconds. Recently, the Boulder group were able to achieve single qubit coherence of more than 1 second, which I think is a very important step, by using magnetic field insensitive transitions. However, the trouble at the moment is that they cannot use their gate directly there. You have to recode before they do this gate, but okay. We have seen right now these decoherence-free subspaces, which live even longer, so the Bell states can be used as an encoding qubit information there, also more than 10 seconds. And yeah, if you're really careful, you can have single qubit coherence of more than 10 minutes, which David Weinland and Jim Bergquist already demonstrated 15 years ago. With that, I want to come to the algorithmic part of my talk. I want to talk a little bit about entanglement swapping. So what is entanglement swapping? I first start out with what is teleportation. Teleportation, you all know, you have two parties, Alice and Bob, usually they are called, and they share a Bell state. And what we want to do now is we want to give Alice a quantum state, and Alice doesn't know what the state is. So what can Alice do? All she can do is she can measure. She does this in a clever way. She measures in a Bell basis. And she retrieves now two bits of classical information, which she then communicates to Bob, and Bob applies a rotation, and magic happens. The original state appears here on this side. What is now entanglement swapping? It's rather easy. You just teleport a state which was previously entangled with a different state. And in this way, you have now established entanglement between that state and that state, even though those two states never interacted directly. This is the quantum circuit which would do this. So you produce a Bell pair, another Bell pair, then you do essentially the teleportation on this part, and in the end you have created entanglement between those two qubits. So this is the teleportation sequence, and this is the entanglement swapping sequence. What we have done in the initial experiments, we have left out that rotation because it adds some complications for us. Instead, we measure, we do a full tomography on all states, and then look simply when we have measured SS for this center two qubits, what we have on the outer qubits. It's kind of post-selection as what the photon people did. So here are the results. So when we have measured DD in the center, we have obtained this Bell state. When we have measured DS, we have we obtained this Bell state, and so forth. And the question is now, what are yeah, the numbers? Here are is listed the fidelity. The fidelity of these states is in the order of 60 to 70%, and the entanglement of formation, which can be seen as a measurement of entanglement, is larger than zero. Nevertheless, when you look, for instance, at this Bell state, this is not a very nice Bell state. Yeah, one population is much higher than the other one. The coherences are reduced, and here these populations are both the same height, but you can see that the coherence is reduced. So we are not really happy with that, and the problem, okay, there are of course experimental imperfections, but it boils more or less down to the fact that our C naught is not good enough. So therefore, we stepped back and we looked now at the C naught. And what we did there is we actually did the process tomography. But first, let me show you how the C naught works in general. So what we do in order to do a C naught is we swap first the quantum information in control bit to the motional degree of freedom, then do the C naught where the motion is now the control bit and the target bit is the target bit, and then swap the quantum information back. And this can be achieved by addressing each ion individually. This is the pulse sequence which achieves this. There are many blue sideband pulses, and this is actually the costly thing for us. Here are the swap pulses. This is a composite phase gate, which is where there are Ramsey pulses, which make then from the phase gate basically then the conditional bit flip. And here you can see what happens, for instance, for these swap pulses. If the ion is in the D level, this blue sideband pulse cannot couple to any level, so the ion stays in the D level, but also the motional mode is not excited. However, if the ion is in the S state, the motion gets excited, and the ion gets also into the D level, and then you have the quantum information in the center of mass mode and can do this phase gate here. We have measured here the truth table, and you can see that this is really sort of a C naught. If you come in with 0, 0, you end up with 0, 0, and if you the control bit, which is the first bit here, is in D, which is in this notation 1, you can see that it's flipped the target bit from DS to DD. So how do we characterize this gate better? And you can basically look at this kind of circuit. Quantum mechanics tells you that everything is a unitary evolution, so you describe it as a unitary evolution. However, this unitary evolution involves also an external bath, the environment. And what you do then, but you are not interested in the environment, and therefore you express this operation as a completely as a positive map. Is that correct? Is it a positive map? Is it? Okay, what you do is you calculate, in the end you're interested in the so-called process matrix, which is written in a certain basis. Usually as the basis we use the Pauli matrices. And in this way, when you know this chi matrix and of course the basis, then you can calculate when you have an arbitrary input density matrix what would be the output density matrix. So how to measure this? And we didn't know really how to measure this, so we asked for advice. And the guy who we asked for advice sits here, Daniel. At that time we didn't know Andrew. And so here's the recipe Daniel gave to us. Choose input states for the process such that the corresponding density matrices form a basis of the space form a basis set for the space of the matrices. For all these input states, do a quantum state tomography of the output state. So you apply the process to this input density matrix, and then you measure what comes out. And then you estimate the chi matrix and use your preferred method. Might be maximum likelihood or some other method. So we use maximum likelihood at the moment. And what that means in our setup, we have 2 qubits for the C0. We have 16 input states to go in this into our setup. We need only 9 different settings to analyze, to do a quantum state tomography. That means in total 144 measurement settings. And in our case, that means about a measurement time of 5 to 10 minutes. So that's not too bad. Here are the results. There's the modulus of the chi matrix, and here's the real and the imaginary part. And I think most of you will not immediately see that this is the C0. Therefore, I write for you the C0 in terms of Pauli operators, this particular C0 here. And you can see then really that these terms which appear here appear also here in the matrix. You see here the identity times identity part, and the Z times identity part appears here. And you can see that these this chi matrix is almost like what you expect it to be. So how to assess now the performance of the C0? One thing that you can readily compute from that is the process fidelity, which is basically the scalar product of the two matrices, of the one which you would expect and the one which you measured. So how good does the experimentally obtained density chi matrix overlap with the ideal process matrix? Another possibility is that you can first generate a random set of input states, then put these input states into that measured chi matrix and look at the output states, and then analyze the overlap of the output states with the one which you would expect from ideal operation. You might think naively that both numbers give you the same, but they don't. Here we see that the process fidelity of this C0 was about 91%, whereas this mean fidelity where we analyze the output states gives slightly higher values. So is that all? So does really the chi matrix tell everything about your quantum process? This must not be necessarily true if you have, for instance, a non-Markovian environment. And this is, of course, important because most quantum algorithms contain more than a single gate operation. And the question is, how good is that description really? So we did an experiment there. We applied quantum process tomography to 2 C0s. So, it's the wrong way. Okay, so what we've done is that we applied 2 C0s, and here we have confirmed what the theorists knew for a long time. 2 C0s in a row is the identity. We have done quantum process tomography of this thing, and we get fidelities in the order of 80%. And when we compare this to multiplying the chi matrix with itself, we achieve only slightly higher fidelities. We expect slightly higher fidelities. So there's a reasonable agreement, but there are already some hints that we have a non-Markovian environment. We can also use that process tomography to investigate a little bit our experimental imperfections. And actually, the data I've shown you was already the improved C0 version. The entanglement swapping was done with a C0 with a fidelity of about 80%. And one problem which we had were these so-called off-resonant excitations. When we want to drive this blue sideband transition here, the carrier transition is much stronger. And even though the laser is detuned by about a megahertz, you still get off-resonant excitations, and this decreases the gate fidelity and limits also the gate speed. And what we have done is that we adiabatically switched on the laser pulses, and in this way, you can see really the difference if you use square pulses to implement the C0 as compared to adiabatic pulses. You can see here really a significant improvement of the fidelity of the C0. So the question I want to pose now is, how useful is quantum process tomography? The first thing is quantum process tomography really necessary to improve the operations? And I would say no. We knew this problem, and we could have easily looked at it directly. So I don't know. It's a good check, but is quantum process tomography practical? Okay, I think we have also discussed this just now. If for small systems, it's really nice, but for larger systems, there's no way you can do this. At least I don't see it well. And the question which arises then, how will we assess our quantum computers in the future? We have discussed this, and I don't know really an answer to this, but maybe the approach of looking at small blocks is sufficient, but I don't know. What we could do there is maybe the same thing as what the people are doing, which are building clocks. They build a clock, and then they check with another clock. So maybe that's a valuable way. But then you should have a different quantum computer. So we should have at least two best with different technologies. Okay, I think I'll skip that and come directly to the electrical coupling of ion qubits, a project which I started recently. And I want to motivate this with this slide. And I want to state that it is really easy to have thousands of ions in a trap and to manipulate them individually. There's not really a problem. The problem, however, is it's almost impossible to control the interaction. And that's what you need to do for quantum computing. So there's a solution which Dave Vineland and his collaborators proposed. And they suggested simply to split up this large ion string into smaller pieces and then handle each part of the string individually. And this can be done with these segmented traps, of which you see here a picture. Another approach is even older. It was proposed by Sirak, Zoller, and Kimball, and Mabuchi, and we have seen this proposal already, the idea is to couple each ion to a cavity and then transmit the quantum information over a fiber or whatever into the next ion trap, and this way you couple these ions, and you have already solved the quantum network problem. What I want to talk now is a different approach proposed by Tian, who is here, presumably, and Rainer Platt and Peter Zoller, where the idea is to couple two ions via a wire. So that's what I want to concentrate now. This is the setting. We have two trapped ions. And what we want to do is we want to transport quantum information through the wire. The important thing is now quantum mechanics tells us during that transport, I mean, you couple a single quantum information into the wire and out of the wire, and if some trace is left in the wire of the quantum information, you cannot have faithfully transmitted your quantum information. So therefore, you might think, okay, I mean, maybe superconductors would work. Okay, put in some numbers. So we assume now that the ion has a distance from the wire of 40 micron, which is important for the coupling strength, that the wire is about 400 micron long. Then you can compute that the coupling strength between the two ions should be in the order of a kilohertz. That's actually quite good. That's only a factor of two slower what we have currently in our system. When I assume a wire resistance of 1 ohm, I can look, can see the following, or the decoherence mechanisms have the following size. What you think might be a big problem is the dissipation of the induced current in that wire. 1 ohm is a macroscopic resistivity. But since that quantum, that excitation, motional excitation, is such a tiny current, the dissipation time is larger than 10,000 seconds. So there's no problem here. Johnson noise at 4 Kelvin would lead to a decoherence time of about 1 second. That's also not a big problem. And the question is, of course, I mean, this is is basically the limit for the T1 time, but what's going on with the T2 time? And, that's very hard. I'll skip that, sorry. So what is going on with the T2 speed 2 times. Let's think for a moment as the system as 3 coupled harmonic oscillator, one ion, another ion, and here in the center the wire. And what we want to do is we want to couple this harmonic oscillator to this harmonic oscillator. What we see is that if the wire has a reasonable size, is that the associated frequency of the wire is more on the order of a gigahertz. And therefore, the center oscillator is detuned from the other two oscillators. What that means is that if we couple from this oscillator to this oscillator, we only virtually excite the center oscillator. And this way, the decoherence properties of this guy should drop out to a large extent. And this works also if the center oscillator is already excited. So the question is really, do we need the superconductor? And to this, I found many people think we don't need the superconductors. Others think we definitely need one. Okay, we will see. So we can do more things with this. This is not only, the applications are not only quantum information. Actually, I'm more motivated by understanding the decoherence properties in this wire. Then we can use it maybe for precision measurements by cooling cooling this ion, and this cooling is transferred over here. We don't need coherence there. We can measure really, really tiny counts of the system. You can imagine to cool here high Q LC circuits, and you can imagine connecting to other qubits. And actually, Dan Heinzen and Wineland proposed many of these things already 15 years ago. And okay, you can have, of course, this vision. I don't know how realistic this is and whether it at all becomes possible, but the idea would be here that we have here a quantum processor part and could be connected to external electronics or even to solid-state qubits, and the ions could serve as a quantum memory, for instance. Okay, with that, I want to sum up. I've shown you that we have done tomography of various entangled states. We have seen that entanglement can live really very long for under certain circumstances. We have seen that we could perform entanglement swapping with post-selection, although we want to do that without post-selection, hopefully this fall. I showed you that we can have now C-naughts with fidelities larger than 90% and how to wire ion traps. And with that, I want to thank you and the group, which, yeah, it was very, of course, very important. And this was really a group effort. You can see all the people in blue contributed significantly to the work I presented to you. Thank you for your attention.